This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Robert Evans, who had a long and very storied career as both a studio head and producer at Paramount Pictures, died last Saturday at age 89. As a studio executive, he oversaw The Godfather and Chinatown. He also was responsible for generating the film adaptations of Rosemary's Baby, Love Story, Barefoot in the Park, and The Odd Couple. In 1994, he wrote a memoir, The Kid Stays in the Picture, that later was made into a critically acclaimed documentary. Terry Gross spoke to Robert Evans in 1994, the year Evans published his memoir. They began by discussing his most famous film project.
I met Mario Puzo as a favor to a literary agent friend of mine named George Weezer, and he needed money to pay off the bookies, actually. And he had this treatment called Mafia. It was 60 pages, and he said the word mafia had never been used before. It was found in the Kefauver Committee, and I was always interested in that kind of a movie. So I gave him $12,000 just to write a treatment called Mafia, and that treatment called Mafia turned into being the novel The Godfather. And we owned the novel for very, very little money because I put up the money for a treatment. Even after we owned it, and we owned it for next to nothing, they still didn't want to make the picture at Paramount because too many people said a mafia picture had never been successful. Anything about the organization, as it was called before the mafia, there had never been one successful film made about the mafia before that. And they wanted me to sell it, and I refused to do it. And we found the reason why there had been no successful mafia films, because they had been made by Jews and not Italians.
Did you think that was the secret?
I must have been, because we had made one 2 years before with Kirk Douglas. It was directed by Marty Ritt, written by Bill Sternberg, starred Luther Adler and Susan Strasberg and Kirk Douglas, all written and directed and produced by Jewish people. And there's a difference, a thin line between a Jew and a Sicilian. And I felt that made the difference. And that's why we gave Francis Coppola his assignment to do it. And by record, he had only made three unsuccessful films before that. Phineas Rainbow, You're a Big Boy Now, and Rain People.
I should point out, you're Jewish, so it's kind of interesting that you really took a stand that it had to be an Italian.
Well, yes, because, and I was right in taking that stand. If I would have done it, I most probably wouldn't have made it the same way. I wanted to smell the spaghetti, Terry.
Several directors turned down The Godfather. Costa Gavras, Ilya Kazan, Arthur Penn.
Not
Italians, yeah.
No Italians. There hadn't been an Italian director, second-generation Italian director in Hollywood at the time, as a matter of fact. It was pre-Martin Scorsese and other Italian directors, and Francis was the only second-generation Italian working in films at the time. He got the nod.
That's how he got the gig, because he was the only Italian.
He got the gig that way, and he would only make it in one way. If he could tell his story as a family chronicle on capitalism in America. That's the way he described it anyway, but we had no choice at the time. And again, as I said, I wanted to smell that spaghetti, and one thing we did, we smelled the spaghetti.
Hey, Mike! Hey, Mikey!
Yeah?
You wanted on the telephone.
Who is it?
Some girl.
Hello, Kay.
How's your father?
He's good. He's gonna make it.
I love you.
Huh?
I love you. Michael?
Yeah, I know.
Tell me you love me.
Yeah, I can't talk.
Can't you say it?
Yeah, I'll see you tonight.
Hey, Mikey, why don't you tell that nice girl you love her? I love you with all of my heart. If I don't see you again soon, I'm gonna die. Hey, come over here, kid. Learn something. You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil, and you fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, some tomato paste. You fry it. You make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil. You shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar, and that's my trick.
Why don't you cut the crap? I got more important things for you to do. How's Paulie?
Oh, Paulie won't see him no more.
You didn't want to cast Al Pacino.
No, I didn't want Al Pacino, and Francis didn't want Jimmy Caan. So we settled on Al Pacino, if he would, and Jimmy Caan as a combination, because it was getting too close to shooting time, and Francis rightfully said to me, you know, you want someone who looks like you and I want someone who looks like me. I mean, we're never going to get together in this part. So, but, and he didn't want Jimmy Kahn at all because Jimmy, he had just done Rain People with him and it got rained on pretty good.
Oh, you know, James Kahn's Jewish, and you wanted to make a whole big thing about Italians in it.
But, you know, but the point, the reason I wanted James Kahn was because Al is like 5'4 or 5'5, and the guy they wanted to play opposite him as part of something was 6'5, and I didn't want to see Mutton Jeff.
Uh-huh.
And there's a size range. Jimmy looked very big next to Al, but he isn't that big in person. I mean, he's an average-sized guy, 5'10 or so. But the fellow they had wanted to put next to Al, it would have looked cosmetically ludicrous. So that's the reason I went with Jimmy.
You say that when you saw Coppola's first cut, you told him he had to make it longer, that he had to put more in. And that's exactly the opposite of what I'd expect a producer to say. It's usually, the film's too long, you'd better cut it.
And not only that, it was around 2 hours and 6 minutes his cut, and we ended up with a picture close to 3 hours. He had shot everything. He had shot that spaghetti, but he took it out in the edit. He was afraid, and I understand that. The distribution company, the theaters want pictures that are 2 hours, so they get turned over. They don't like a three-hour movie. But this film was not about a slice of life. It was about an era. And it took, and it's not a little picture. The canvas was there to make it hold. You see, sometimes the longer a film is, the shorter it plays, and the shorter it is, the longer it plays. Because if you lose the text, if it's one single dimensional, it can play awfully long at 90 minutes, and it can play short at 3 hours. And we took a real chance of letting it play long. If it would have played short, it would have been The Untouchables.
You say the ending was really a mess. That there was no ending.
That's correct. There was no ending, and we had a lot of mayhem.
What was the ending like?
It wasn't written. Mm-hmm. There wasn't an ending. We were going to edit the ending, and neither Francis nor myself came up with that edit. As I talk about in the book, a man named Peter Zinner, who is one of the two editors, choreographed the mixture of the baptism of young Michael and the mass killings that went on, and it was very operatic. And Francis is a very operatic director, and he loved what he saw when it was edited together that way, though it wasn't written that way. And so many films have emulated that ending. It's among the classic endings in film history. And nothing to do with either Francis or my own talents. It was Peter Zinner's extraordinary eye and rhythm that made that baptism ending work.
You say that when The Godfather was being made, really most people did not want Brando to be cast.
Not most people. Nobody wanted him. Francis wanted him, and I understood why he wanted him. And the only way we got him into the picture was Francis was brilliant enough to do a silent screen test of him. And once you saw that silent screen test, you knew there's only one person to play the part. It was Marlon. At that point, Marlon's career was very deep into the red. He hadn't made a successful film in years. And he wanted the gig as well. He didn't do it for the artistic purposes. Though he had claimed he had loved the book, I didn't even believe he read it. He wanted the part, and he got the part. And he made history with it, and also made his own second history with making it.
I hoped that we could come here and reason together. And as a reasonable man, I'm willing to do whatever's necessary to find a peaceful solution to this problem.
Then we are agreed. The traffic in drugs will be permitted, but controlled. And Don Corleone will give her protection in the East, and there will be the peace.
But I must have strict assurance from Corleone. As time goes by and his position becomes stronger, will he attempt any individual vendetta?
Look, we are all reasonable men here. We don't have to give assurances as if we were lawyers.
You talk about vengeance. Is vengeance going to bring your son back to you? Or my boy to me? I forgo the vengeance of my son. But I have selfish reasons. My younger son was forced to leave this country because of this Salazzo business. All right, I have to make arrangements to bring him back here safely, clear of all these false charges. But I'm a superstitious man. And if some unlucky accident should befall him, if he should get shot in the head by a police officer, or if he should hang himself in his jail cell, or if he's struck by a bolt of lightning, I'm going to blame some of the people in this room. And that I do not forgive. But that aside, let me say that I swear on the souls of my grandchildren that I will not be the one to break the peace we've made here today.
Producer Robert Evans is my guest, the former head of production at Paramount. You produced Chinatown, a great movie. You cast Jack Nicholson as the leading man in this. Why did you want him?
First of all, he had never played a straight leading man before. Secondly, I've always looked at Jack, and I discovered him, actually, not discovered him for film, but for big time film when he was in a Barbra Streisand picture, On a Clear Day. Jack has a smile. Before he even opens his mouth, the rafters shake when he smiles. It's a billion-dollar smile. In playing the part, his natural instinct, however, was to do something that was different, and that's how he and Roman came up with the idea of that blade going into his nose and cutting his nose wide open. And watching the bandage, and the bandage less than the scar less all through the movie, was a brilliant conceptual move, and it was subliminal. You didn't realize it, but it was a great character hook for Jack to play that role.
Well, you say that Robert Towne, who wrote Chinatown, is still really angry with you about how the ending of Chinatown was changed. So how was it changed compared to what Robert Towne had originally written?
Well, Robert was definite upon it. He wanted the character that John Huston was playing to be killed at the end, and Roman wanted the Faye Dunaway character to be killed. He felt it was more unique that way, that evil did win out at the end, and thus it didn't make it a, quote, Hollywood movie. Robert thought Roman's thought was demented. I was a swing vote in it, and I went along with Roman. To this day, Bob Towne thinks it's a mistake. There's one thing, he won the Academy Award for it, but I suppose that doesn't matter. He still thinks it would have been better the other way. I mean, to this day, if you had him on your show, he'd tell you that.
But I think he did.
I'm sure he must have. He only became the biggest writer in town, not to use a pun, but Towne became the biggest writer in town from Chinatown.
So that famous line, "It's Chinatown, Jake," that said at the end probably wouldn't have been said at the end if the original
Yes, it would have.
It would have been.
It would have been said anyway, but it wouldn't have made sense. See, Chinatown was not supposed to be, per se, Chinatown. It wasn't about Chinatown. It was a state of mind.
Robert Evans spoke with Terry Gross in 1994. He died last Saturday of natural causes at age 89.